friends, hello. Thank you so much for joining us. This is Ellen Kamai, the natural nurse, and we're bringing you, as we do every Tuesday morning from 10 to 11 a.m., the natural nurse and Dr. Z, and we're so happy to be with you today. We love to share information about natural medicine with you and have been doing so for many, many years. You can always find us at naturalnurse.com or Facebook, The Natural Nurse, and we love getting feedback from our listeners. Today, we have as our guest Dr. Sylvia Hess. Dr. Hess is a medical doctor who graduated from the University of California, San Diego, with a B.S. cum laude in biochemistry and cell biology. She received her Doctor of Medicine degree from Creighton University School of Medicine, and then she completed an orthopedic surgery residency at the Fort Worth Affiliated Hospital Program and pursued subspecialty fellowships training in pediatric orthopedic surgery at Shriners Hospital for Children in Portland, Oregon. Dr. Hess established a pediatric orthopedic surgery practice in Miami, Florida. I guess she was tired of all that gray weather up in Portland. And prior to relocating to New York City, where she is now at the Manhattan Spine and Sports Medicine Facility, they provide office-based, comprehensive, non-surgical orthopedic medicine evaluations with a particular focus on adult and juvenile athletic injuries, chronic musculoskeletal overuse disorders, in addition to acute and chronic back pain disorders. We're very happy to have Dr. Hess on board with us today. She strongly believes in a holistic approach to providing musculoskeletal medical care to her patients. So thank you so much for being our guest today, Dr. Hess, on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
Good morning, Helen. Thank you for having me.
Now, one thing I'd like to do is go back in time, because you actually have a very extensive training in what we will call conventional medicine. And I want to be clear here, we're not using the word traditional. I use the word traditional when we're talking about ancient medicine that has thousands of years of effective and safe use, such as traditional Chinese medicine, traditional Ayurvedic medicine, traditional Western herbal medicine. But I specifically am using the word conventional training because that is a very high level of medical training, which it would be called modern medicine. And that's really what it looks like your path has been through in terms of your education and practice in past years.
Right. It's exciting that everything that one learns ultimately and then which one incorporates into daily practice, one does not necessarily learn in formal educational processes. So the degrees might demonstrate one element of what I can offer patients in terms of the knowledge base, but everything that I've acquired since then interacting with a lot of colleagues in the fields of, as you mentioned, Eastern medicine, manual therapy such as chiropractic or Rolfing, integrative approaches such as Feldenkrais, that has made me more of what you're describing as a holistic practitioner, and that I acquired on my own 3 years of experiencing it also as a patient myself. So I think my inquisitiveness on that level to help myself has also assisted me in this.
And many doctors do share that. So when you originally, I mean, obviously, as a young person, you had a great interest in higher education. And, you know, what led you to want to become a physician in the first place?
Well, it's interesting. I guess, you know, my father's a mechanical engineer, PhD. My mother was a homemaker, yet always, you know, being extremely supportive of any kind of interest we showed, and mine happened to be in the sciences. I thought I'd become an archaeologist when I was in grade school. Then that became a botanist and kind of, you know, biology professor when I was in high school, and then ultimately I realized that bench research, which was required to, you know, become a educator on a higher level wasn't for me, so I pursued being a volunteer at the local hospital, doing everything from the candy striper to Spanish translation for patient visitations to shadowing a doctor in the emergency room. And I think all the looking at all the perspectives then of what it meant to be in healthcare, that excited me more than basic science, if you will. So I like to apply the knowledge rather than, to people. Yeah.
So for a process, through a process of self-reflection and actually getting in there and trying different systems for yourself, that's how so you evolved into going to medical school.
Right.
And, of course, through being a surgeon, you help many, many thousands of people. It's not like you're against surgery.
No. It has its place. And, clearly there are certain conditions that, are best treated surgically, except that, these days when we have so many other alternatives to, pain management, musculoskeletal injury conditions, unless something is completely broken and has to be repaired, like a massive rotator cuff, tear, there's many alternatives to surgery, and it doesn't vilify what surgeons do. It just makes the criteria to pursue that much more stringent. It has its complications, and it has to be applied appropriately. So clearly trauma is the easiest to understand.
Well, let me ask you one thing. This is a little off the subject, and I know this is not your area of expertise, but I just would like your opinion, because I've never been able to find, for instance, with hernias, even in very young boys. Is there any alternative to surgery?
Well, when you're looking at a structural problem that then can have consequences that might be, life-threatening, like incarcerating a loop of your intestine, that then is something you need to repair.
Right. So there's no. I've been looking for years for natural treatments for those. I'm not even talking about maybe something like an inguinal hernia. I'm not sure that that's so life-threatening, but it does have to. There doesn't seem to be any particular natural way to really fix that. And the reason I'm asking you, even though I know that's not your area of expertise in terms of urology, you are a pediatric surgeon, so you certainly have enough experience with those kinds of things.
In pediatric orthopedics, we do assess congenital issues as well as developmental, anything from club feet to scoliosis to genetic conditions influencing the musculoskeletal system. So we identify those things, and then we work with our colleagues who such as urologist or neurologist to handle it. I know a little bit about most things in pediatrics, but
I think saying a little bit, you're probably being pretty modest about that. But so, in other words, you don't know for that particular condition, an inguinal hernia, even though you've investigated natural therapies and you like to use them first. That's the whole point of where we'll go with this discussion. Not that you think surgery should be thrown out the door because it's a life-saving intervention, but perhaps it's not always the best first choice. It could be saved for a last choice if needed. But in the situation of something like a hernia, I don't think there's any kind of like topical treatment for that I know of.
Right. As far as placing surgery in the realm of treatment options, again, from my perspective, I assess patients, and if their condition warrants intervention surgically, because this will give them definitive management for their problem, which they have pursued alternatives, then this is what I tell them, even if it's the first time I encounter them. And I think that's just being a prudent physician.
So that is really an important statement, because really I think that's how all medicine should be practiced, going from when we look at the risk-benefit ratio profile, we should be moving from those things that have the greatest benefit with the least risk first, and then if that doesn't work, or if we need to go further, then we can go down a spectrum of things that might have a higher risk for the benefit that it might ensue. But, you know, when you go straight to surgery, sometimes I think you're bypassing many of those less risky options.
Well, at the end of the day, I think what needs to be put in perspective is that it is a change to one's being, one's anatomy. You know, if you're altering the structure, the consequences of even scar tissue down the road for functional restrictions is huge. I see that all the time, especially for spinal post-surgical patients, and to recover movement and postural integration post-surgically. Scar tissue has a huge impact, which they have to deal with over years of rehabilitation. But nobody really talks about that. But we see it in clinical practice. So,
well, in your center, which people can find you at the Manhattan Spine and Sports Medicine Facility, and we will list the phone number and the web link on your show, because, you know, this show will be archived, so if someone hears this and loves it and would like to share it with their friends, you can listen anytime. You can also go to manhattanspine.com. That's very easy to remember, manhattanspine.com, to find Dr. Hess's clinic. And, you know, I really like Dr. Hess in terms of you using the word mindfully considering each patient's unique functional and psychosocial requirements. That doesn't seem to be the kinds of words you'll usually hear from a surgeon.
Well, I think perhaps enough of my colleagues think the same way. They just might not have to put it in a biography about themselves. But to me, these words are extremely meaningful. Again, I'm coming from not only a physician's perspective, but a patient perspective. So, having a ailment, injury, chronic condition, unless you address the emotional and psychosocial elements that influence this condition, you're not going to achieve complete recovery for a lot of people. You have to work with their family. If someone's incapacitated and they're unable to, you know, help perform activities of daily living, you have to get an aide, you know, clearly. You know, people who are dealing with chronic pain and they're having struggles with their workplace, you have to improve their ergonomics and make sure they're not getting further impact on their condition negatively. You have to, facilitate them seeing a psychologist, or, you know, getting energy, you know, healing. You know, people are open-minded in many ways. Some people prefer acupuncture. So as long as you can influence the psychology, you're also going to influence somebody's perception of their condition, and then the pain that they're experiencing with that condition generally is managed much better than if you ignore it. And if I see patients who prefer to just take a pill or to just sign up for surgery, it's those patients that will unfortunately not have the best outcomes because they're ignoring
because they want
part
someone else to completely fix everything.
That's right.
Real quick.
Right.
Which
that's
is,
right.
You know, I would say that that's a real focus of modern medicine, and it was even in the past more so, since we see it doesn't really work now. But I think that was part of the glamour of it, like, just do whatever you want, we'll take care of you. Between drugs and surgery, everything will be fine, just patch you back up like a car.
You know, it's those kind of patients who actually scared me. They didn't want to have all the risks and benefits described, and then the last thing you want to do is actually perform a procedure on them, because at the end of the day, they leave everything up to you, but they don't recognize that the hardest part is actually for them. Subsequent to the procedures, so I'm all about educating people. And if something sounds too simple, you know, then or a simple solution like a pill, yeah, then it may not. How do I say? I guess I want to simplify what I'm trying to tell you.
You're doing a very good job.
There's no simple solution for this issue. You need to come on board with a team approach here. I can
now,
be a cheerleader, and I can be a guide.
That is excellent. So as a physician, you feel that your role would be more as a cheerleader and a guide, which is just an excellent way to think about it, because I do believe that the original meaning of the word doctor had to do more with teacher than someone who fixes everything like a mechanic. So that's a very good way to modify that belief system. Now, we're going to take a little break right here, Dr. Hess, and when we come back, we will introduce you once again to our listening audience, and we're going to talk about pain then, the techniques that you use that might be more of a topical analgesic nature rather than going right to surgery, because certainly the pain is what often brings people to see any kind of orthopedist, and then we have to have a game plan for helping the person get out of that pain syndrome. So we're going to take a little break right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z, and when we come back, we will continue our discussion with Dr. Hess, and we'll talk about her clinic again so you can find her in the future. We'll be right back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
On this edition of The Natural Medicine Chest, we'll talk about high blood pressure or hypertension.
Hypertension or high blood pressure is a disease of the Western world and a product of modern civilization. Cultures that continue to adhere to an indigenous lifestyle, which includes low stress levels, a non-refined whole foods diet, as well as vigorous exercise, experience virtually no episodes of essential hypertension. It is very interesting to note that when individuals from these societies emigrate to Western countries and adopt Western habits, they too fall prey to hypertension. Naturopathic treatment of hypertension has not changed essentially in the last century. The mainstay of the treatment still relies on diet, exercise, stress reduction, lifestyle modification, with secondary support from other modalities such as hypotensive phytotherapy or herbal medicine, hydrotherapy, which is the therapeutic use of water, clinical nutrition, as well as homeopathy. We'll focus on phytotherapy in this edition of The Natural Medicine Chest.
Let's talk about Taraxacum officinalis. This is an unpopular nuisance to many homeowners trying to build that perfect lawn. However, this common weed, the dandelion, is a powerful yet safe botanical medicine for the treatment of hypertension. In a Romania study in 1974, the common dandelion was found to be as potent a diuretic as a commonly used drug called Lasix. Dandelion, however, due to its rich levels of potassium, acted against potassium ion depletion, a dangerous condition known as hypokalemia, seen as a side effect of many antihypertensive drugs which promote diuresis. The leaf of the dandelion was a more effective medicine than the root, although the root is utilized by naturopathic physicians and has a powerful liver-specific medicinal quality.
Crataegus oxycantha, also known in the vernacular as hawthorn, is a common tree in the family Rosaceae, or the rose family. Extracts of the plant in the Western literature date back far beyond the Middle Ages. Even the Chinese were privy to its usage, especially as a digestive tonic. The therapeutic principles are found in extracts from the leaves, berry-like fruits, as well as the flowers. In Europe, Crataegus is well respected for its effects at lowering blood pressure, blood lipids, reducing angina attacks, and preventing and perhaps reversing atherosclerotic deposition in arterial walls. This plant has demonstrated a remarkable safety record, but because of its powerful effects, It should not be used with certain cardiac or hypotensive drugs and should be used by a qualified practitioner of alternative medicine.
Other herbs are also helpful for hypertension, such as garlic, olive, and olive oil, and ginkgo biloba.
So if the pressures of life are making your blood boil, don't forget about these herbal medicines the next time you reach into the natural medicine chest.
Dr. Z, and you're here with your host, Ellen Kamai, the natural nurse, and we'd love you to join us. Visit the website at naturalnurse.com. If you would like to get a free newsletter, just go into the lower left-hand corner of the webpage and type in only your email address, and you'll start to get our newsletter, which is an unbranded newsletter with lots of information about natural interventions. And if you'd like to join us on the ground, just go to naturalnurse.com and look at schedule. We have many classes coming up, some of which are in New York City. We have one coming up, which is a tour to Chinatown, and we spend the day investigating Chinese medicine, such as tongue and pulse diagnosis, traditional Chinese herbal medicine. We do qigong in the park. It's a wonderful day, sort of like going on a vacation to another country, as well as educational. And we do herbal certification courses. Those are available both online and on ground. This year we'll be hosting many classes at a beautiful, huge biodynamic organic farm on Long Island, which is called Restoration Farm. And we'll have classes in outside herbal identification as well as making our own medicine, where everybody goes out, gets the plants, and makes salves, tinctures, cough syrups, and takes them home with them. So you really get a wonderful skill. It's a survival skill as well as a, just for fun as well. You never know. Hopefully it'll just stay for fun. You never know when there's disasters around and there's no food or medicine around, and you will be equipped with the knowledge and the know-how of how to make your own medicine from wild plants that are growing right now, right outside your door. So you can find out about that as well, or visit us at naturalnurse.com. And or Facebook, The Natural Nurse. Today we have as our guest Dr. Sylvia Hess, who is a highly trained medical doctor with degrees and all kinds of practices in many areas of the United States, and she is now actually available in Manhattan at the Spine and Sports Medicine, at Manhattan Spine and Sports Medicine. You can find her at manhattanspine.com. And Dr. Hess strongly believes in a holistic approach to providing musculoskeletal medical care to her patients by mindfully considering each patient's unique functional and psychosocial requirements. She finds that better and more lasting positive outcomes actually occur. And so that's what she focuses on. So thank you so much for being our guest today, Dr. Hess.
Thank you for inviting me.
Now, when we started on our break, we just were about to get to pain. Because am I correct that most patients come to see a physician like yourself or any orthopedist because they are suffering with pain?
That's correct. Either acute or chronic pain, or functional loss of range of motion, perhaps loss of sensation. acute trauma.
Okay. So now that's something that needs to be addressed by the physician. You can't just say, oh, well, we'll just, do something, but we're not going to address this pain issue. And, of course, the first method of choice, even before surgery, is certainly going to be the use of various kinds of drugs.
And then when you look at that, they may be the right thing for a short period of time. But if you look at some of the news lately in terms of the adverse effects of these drugs, you really have to start to consider if they're the right course of action, especially long term.
Right. And, you know, as far as, you know, minor aches and pains that most people have experienced throughout their life, that's one thing. And people can use over-the-counter preparations or, if they prefer. But if it persists, or should pain be intense or associated with some kind of dysfunction, that really needs assessment. You need to understand the diagnosis and then understand what are your choices in managing it. So that's what I do. most commonly, patients will have tried over-the-counter preparations such as, acetaminophen or the non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. And all too commonly, the patient is not even using a therapeutic dose, or they exceed the recommended dose. So, on the side effect spectrum, most commonly I'm seeing people with gastric upset because they took too many medications in the aspirin family, of which there's many. The common ones are Motrin or Advil.
Well, let's go into that. You know, we just say those casually in terms of Advil. See, we like to use herbs in our practice, such as Nature's Answers, turmeric and ginger. You know, turmeric and ginger has some really advanced research on its anti-inflammatory properties with a much better risk-benefit ratio. But when you say Advil and Tylenol, they are not without risk. People think they are since they're over-the-counter meds.
That's right. That's a very common misconception. And so I personally prefer to apply local treatments to local problems.
Wow, that's a nice saying.
It has a greater efficacy because you're influencing the target directly, and so you're able to provide hopefully the greatest therapeutic benefit to your target tissue. So that can include topicals, it can include thermal, either cold or heat, it can include like a transcutaneous electrical nerve stimulation to a region, it can include injectables. So I think from a standpoint of outcome, it's much more, if you treat locally, you can have a much more reliable, low side effect profile.
Right, and also, you know, certainly a lot less adverse effects. What are some of the things that have come out lately about some of the things like Advil and Tylenol that people sort of just pop like candy?
Well, clearly, you know, what one knows about Tylenol is that of acutic liver failure, overuse of Tylenol is the most common cause of liver failure in the United States. And on a chronic term, also it's the second most common cause of liver failure that needs transplant.
So, wow, that's big. That's really big.
That's right. As far as using it in someone who has addiction, certainly then the side effect profile can occur much sooner.
Now, how big is this pain problem? Because I guess, you know, as we age, more and more people are seeing that pain is something that they need to deal with.
Well, that's a whole new discussion. The baby boomers are here. They are so active. I have people who are involved in basically semi-professional softball and ballroom dancing, and patients coming in and they're 95 and very active with their community. So we're having to teach them how to remain strong into into higher, you know, age brackets, how to maintain proper bone density, how to exercise appropriately for their, physiology, how to increase their performance, how to
those are all things people might
proper
come
diet,
for.
Proper hydration. You know, there's a 1% loss of lean muscle mass annually as we age beyond the age of 40, and so I counsel my older patients strongly about proper diet, because without that, they can't maintain their greatest function. And if they lose more muscle mass, they then become more unsteady, they lose balance abilities, they lose transferabilities.
So is there nothing we can do about that? Because I know I kind of work out with weights my whole life, and I haven't really seen a very big loss. I don't know if it's genetic, because my mother's 85 years old, and she swims 2 miles a day and has a totally perfect body.
But it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you
that could
do,
be, yeah.
Yes. The more active you are, the more you'll maintain. I unfortunately see a lot of people who then, as they age, they don't keep up with the exercise appropriately, and then lose muscle mass to a critical point where then daily activities such as stair climbing and transferring from a chair to standing become challenging. And then the, if they come in for their back problem, it's not uncommon that they'll also present with, you know, worsening knee arthritis the weaker they get in the pelvic girdle, because they can't support themselves properly and get these postural syndromes. So it's a continuum.
Well, you're very
involved. You're clearly on the proactive side, and that's how I like to hear it.
Right, you're very involved with bone density also. So I just want to talk about that a little bit. I know a lot of the bone density drugs also have very negative profiles in terms of risk, but one that I've been interested in is calcitonin, which seems to have a better risk-benefit ratio. But what is your opinion of using calcitonin in people that are getting problems with bone density reading?
I have to actually admit that that's not a topic that I really address with my patients.
Okay.
When it comes to this, I actually refer to their internist and endocrinologist, just because I find that that's not exactly
your specialty,
my expertise. Yes.
Now, what about using topical applications? Because that seemed to be much more popular years ago, and I think it's gone out of favor really incorrectly, because I think it's wonderful in terms of what you're talking about in terms of treating locally and with a very low risk.
Right. As far as what's old is new, the trend is returning. The trend is also returning for increased interest in Eastern medicine. So I'm excited about that. As far as topical analgesics, what you're able to do is influence the pain processing from the periphery to the central nervous system, and by decreasing the pain transmission to the central nervous system, you can actually influence the entire pain experience. So I think it's a powerful tool. There's things like menthol, the methyl salicylates, and the capsaicins. Those are camphor also. Those are four different types of natural substances, although both the menthol, methyl salicylate, they can be synthesized in a lab, but these are most commonly found in preparations such as Salon Paz, which, they have a 12-hour acting pain relief patch, also for arthritis. And
now, what would be on something like that? Because I see that on the news. It's called Salon Paz, and that's a funny name. I don't know where that. I wonder where that pass comes from, what that name means. Do you have any idea?
That's not exactly something I explored.
Okay, I'm just wondering. Yeah, they got that. It must have a story like everything does. But what kind of things are used as a topical analgesic in something like that?
Yeah, so there you have menthol and methyl salicylate. Menthol has a counter-irritant effect. What is a counter-irritant? Basically, it stimulates the nervous tissue, and with repeated I should keep it very simple. It has a counter-irritant effect, but it stimulates some cold receptors. And by stimulating the cold receptors, it actually provides a distraction from the primary pain. So by the cold receptor stimulation has a analgesic effect. Then you have methyl salicylate, which is related to the aspirins, derived commonly from wintergreen oil. And what it does, it suppresses synthesis of prostaglandins. These are hormones which play a central role in both, you know, inflammation, pain, and fever. And what then occurs is that you have a fever reduction, an analgesic effect, and an anti-inflammatory effect, which is similar to the over-the-counter non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, yet has a lower side effect profile when applied topically. There are some limitations to using this product. You cannot use it in lactating women or pregnant women, as salicylates do find their way into the breast milk, and this can have adverse effects for babies. But applied for adults who are not pregnant, the combination of menthol and methyl salicylate in a study that has been done once this product has come out to market, they found a 40% reduction in pain report by patients compared to use of placebo. So it has been found to be quite effective up to 12 hours.
What about once somebody has used it for a while? Does the body sort of get used to it so they're not going to react as significantly in the future, or does it have an additive effect, or neither? Does it just stay the same in terms of its efficacy?
That's a good question. There really aren't that many randomized long-term studies on most of these products, and so that is not something I've come across. You know, as far as some other products that you're not going to want to use repeatedly, like camphor. Camphor is utilized commonly in some of these over-counter topicals. With repeated use, you can get eczema, irritation
of the
skin.
Oh, right, because you told us it's an irritant, right.
Yeah. Now, if you know, there's capsaicin, which is a derivative of hot chili pepper. That is a powerful topical, commonly used for things like shingles, also arthritis. And what it does, it stimulates the sensory nerve to release substance P. And what is substance P? It's a component that is pro-inflammatory and is released by sensory neurons, and then ultimately can send pain signals to the brain. So what the capsaicin does, by making the sensory nerve release the substance P over a period of application, which is needed for the therapeutic effect, you're actually depleting the amount of this pro-inflammatory substance, which means ultimately you're going to have less pain transmission to the brain, and ultimately less pain. So you're defunctionalizing these pain fibers. So powerful tool, does have to be repeatedly applied at least for 3 days, multiple times throughout the day, for full effect. Downside is it can, cause a burning, prickling kind of sensation. And clearly you have to wash your hands carefully.
And I guess, especially a guy goes to the bathroom or something after putting it on, he might
clearly
be dancing around a little, but I don't think it's actually dangerous. Is that true? I mean, it's annoying rather than dangerous.
Right. You just need to stay away from mucous membranes, right. So,
Doctor Hess, hold that thought. When we come back, we're going to continue our discussion. You talked about a lot of things, such as transcutaneous electroneurostimulation, which I have seen very, very positive effects with, and I think those things are evolving, as well as, other information about considering the use of topicals before the use of some of the other more aggressive and adverse effect-laden oral medication. So we will be right back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Thank you so much for joining us for another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z right here on Progressive Radio Network. That is Gary Knowles, Progressive Radio Network, and you can find us at prn.fm. One of the wonderful things, I guess you just heard all the great shows, or many of the great shows that we have available. It's not just for your listening pleasure, although, of course, we hope that you enjoy it, but it's also chock full with information that you can use to better your life and the life of the planet, as well as your family and your internal environment, like your own body. And that's what we're talking about today. We are here with Dr. Sylvia Hess. She is a specialist at the Manhattan Spine and Sports Medicine Clinic. It's called ManhattanSpine.com, located in Midtown Manhattan. And she provides orthopedic, chiropractic, physical therapy, integrative medicine, pain management, spinal decompression, and PRP, platelet-rich plasma therapy treatments. So a lot of interesting things that Dr. Sylvia Hess has been doing after her years of high levels of education in conventional medicine, as well as being deeply involved in less aggressive but often more effective techniques. Thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Hess.
Thank you for inviting me.
Dr. Z. Now, you were talking about some topical therapies such as Salonpas, which are very easy for people to just use themselves. Do they need a prescription and to see a specialist like yourself to try something like that, and perhaps instead of an Advil or ibuprofen?
No, they don't have to have a prescription. It is available over the counter. It is available in gels, so for easy application to joints, for instance. It comes as patches, which are very convenient. No fuss, especially when for low back, larger regions. What needs to be understood is that it's effective for mild to moderate pain. It's FDA approved for that, and the only one of the patches is that for moderate pain. It's great for arthritis, sprains, strains, simple backache, stiff necks, or muscles. The precaution on all these, the use of these products, is the person needs to be realistic. How severe is their injury, and do they have a functional impairment or intensity of pain that really needs to be further assessed? So generally speaking, if your symptoms are not responding within a few days, then you ought to have it evaluated, as pain is extremely subjective. Some people's tolerance to pain is exceedingly high. And unfortunately, when they present, they actually can show significant injuries where a comparable, another person might have immediately presented to the emergency room. So that needs to be put in perspective, that everybody's pain perception is different. Therefore, yes, these products are out there. Put it in reasonable perspective that, guidance by a physician is warranted should your initial symptoms not respond to this type of management.
Now, you talked about the fact that in your, what is platelet-rich plasma therapy? Because I think that might be new to some patients, and apparently you offer that at the Manhattan Spine Clinic.
Right. It's actually a fantastic tool in biological therapeutics, meaning we can use the body's own ability to heal and regenerate tissues. In our common application here, we treat things like tendonitis, strains of the rotator cuff,
various conditions like that.
That's right. Also Achilles tendinoses, and I commonly treat arthritis, primarily osteoarthritis of the knee, shoulder, also hip. And so what platelets are a component in our blood, and these cells are the initial responders to injury. If you have, for instance, a laceration, platelets will aggregate to the site and will make a clot. Then, in the process of stopping the bleeding, these platelets, in the process of having made the clot, then get activated, send out a lot of growth factors, which then stimulate the regenerative processes, which we innately have. We need to make collagen, we need to make epithelial cells, we need to make vascular cells.
Is this an injection, or how is platelet-rich plasma, PRP, how is that therapy accomplished?
Yes, it is administered in form of an injection, and essentially the site of injury is your target. If, for instance, you're applying it for rotator cuff tendinitis or partial tears, it's not necessarily just one injection into the tissue. You might be targeting it multiple times with multiple needle passes.
What is in this injection?
Well, it's basically your blood that is taken from, patient gives blood, we put it in a centrifuge, the filtration device and the centrifuging concentrate platelets and some plasma, which, again, it's a enriched
solution. So I want to tell you, we've used this, and we called it something else like autosanguinous nosotherapy. Was similar, just a similar thing where it was taken from the patient themselves. It really sounds interesting.
Right. So what I'm finding, as are my colleagues who are using it, is, for instance, in arthritis, the intensity of inflammation is reduced. The range of motion is improved. We're finding that it's long-lasting as far as requirements for retreatment. Once it's injected, at six-week mark, it's reassessed how the outcome is. All of these treatments of PRP are administered in addition to physical therapy. These injectable treatments do not live in isolation. Without the physical recuperation of muscle control, of the joints being treated, of balance, then these treatments don't have the best of outcomes. So It's physical therapy plus PRP, and it is a completely natural treatment with really no side effects, no possibility of having a negative reaction, because there's no it's from you to you. Yes, with any injectable therapies, there could be a risk of infection if you enter a joint. But again, everything's done sterilely, so we don't really commonly see that at all.
Well, that's just, you know, very, very interesting new information for many of our patients who joined us today. And I want to thank you so much for being our guest right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And listeners, you can find out more at naturalnurse.com or Facebook The Natural Nurse. And for today's guest, you can go to Manhattan Spine and Sports Medicine to find out more. And thank you so much for having a very informative conversation with us right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And thank you, listeners. Until next time, this is Ellen Kamai, The Natural Nurse, hoping that you stay healthy.